Blog Talk Radio.
And greetings, Lord Hotep, to everyone. Welcome to a special edition of New Day Resurrection and Liberation. As we pay tribute to two of our giants, two of our pioneers, when it comes to the issue of Black human rights and, of course, reparation. But that said, MWM is now initiating several new components as a part of the Black Print Agenda 25. And with that, we are now in our 25-year anniversary commemoration, a year-long commemoration that will culminate in October, in particularly with our first Million Woman World March and our first Global Africana Women's Power and Leadership Summit 2023. Now, we're going to be telling you more information about that very soon. And with that said, there are new Zoom meetings coming. We had them up until the so-called holiday season, and we are going to resume our Zoom meetings in another week. We'll be giving you more information about that. They will begin our national and international organizing now. And so, again, we are getting ready to put the website up and also other kinds of social media apparatuses to get folks ready for something that is definitely going to be historic. And we're talking about millions of African women from all over the world assembling all at one time, pretty much. It might be a little time difference, but you all get the gist of it for that weekend. With one voice, although we will be focusing on many, many issues, but it'll be in the spirit of our ancestors, in the spirit of oneness. I'm going to tell you more about that a little later on, but for now, today, we are launching officially as a part of the recognition of the great Paul Robeson's Day of Ascension, meaning the day that he became an ancestor on this day. We are launching it today. We kind of did some pre-launching starting on January 18th, which was the commemoration of the ascension of Dr. Imari Obadeli. Many do not know of him, and so we want to make certain that as we proceed with the MWM Universal Movement's Recharge Genocide 21, we're going to make certain that the history and legacy of many who have come before us, but particularly when it comes to focusing on justice for our people, focusing on, of course, human rights violations and the necessary reparatory justice slash remedies slash reparations that must now be obtained. So, family, without further ado, I'm going to cue something up because I really want you to hear for yourselves Paul Robeson. And then we're going to also play some excerpts from Dr. Imari Obadeli. Again, two very, very important, significant brothers of African descent, our people, who definitely not only stood tall, told the line, as they say, but was relentless, unapologetic, and so forth. So now, with MWM and the Recharge Genocide 21, as we get ready for a major event that's coming in July, our Queen Mother More weekend. We're going to be leading up to that with a lot of good things for you. So again, here we are with Paul Robeson, one of our first what we call virtual tutorials. You'll be hearing more about that soon as well as we get our YouTube channel ready and other tools to not only educate, edify, train, mobilize and organize our masses from the grassroots to the boardroom and beyond. Paul Robeson.
Paul Robeson was remarkable for many reasons. In the 1920s, the son of a former slave played professional football while studying at Rutgers and Columbia Law School. A brilliant mind and a great athlete, but Robeson is best remembered for his voice, one of the most distinctive in American music, a bass baritone so rich it was compared to deep bells ringing.
He must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling.
Through his music, Paul Robeson gave voice to the hardships of the slave experience, suffused with dignity and defiance, and it resonated with workers of all colors during the toughest years of the Great Depression.
Man, river, he just keeps rolling along.
Robeson performed around the world, packing the great concert halls of Europe and less traditional venues like mine sites, sometimes accompanied by jovially racist newsreel reporters.
When you see a miner and a film star together, the husky one's the miner.
Well, usually.
And before he went away, of course, they asked him to sing.
I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he.
Robeson's choice of songs often carried a strongly pro-union, pro-worker message. In 1960, he gave an impromptu performance for construction workers at Bennelong Point on the site of the Sydney Opera House.
But I keep laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying. And old man River, he'll just keep rolling along.
While he's in Australia, Robeson also spoke to the ABC about civil rights and the potential impact of black voters on that year's presidential election.
If they ask, is Nixon going to help the Negro people most? Do we think he will, or Kennedy? Whichever way we decide, we'll decide who's president of the United States. That's how organized we are.
That I don't know that organized is quite the word I meant. Okay. I meant all of it, but as of one mind, perhaps.
Well, no, I say that like today. We are one mind on this. We want our freedom.
Yes.
We want. Let's put it another way. We want to be full citizens, first class, not second class.
No, I'd like to.
We want to go to school as everybody else. That's right.
He was right. Kennedy courted the black vote and won. But by then, Paul Robeson was a pariah in the country. Within a year, he would suffer an almost complete physical and mental breakdown, the exact cause of which is still a mystery, steeped in Cold War intrigue. In the late 1940s, Robeson had met with President Harry Truman to demand anti-lynching laws after four African Americans were lynched in Georgia. Truman abruptly ended the meeting when Robeson warned if the government wouldn't protect them, black folks would have to protect themselves. It tapped into white America's fear of black militancy. 2 years later, Robeson appeared before a Senate committee looking at a bill demanding all communists register with the government. He'd made no secret of his left-wing views. The former star law student was repeatedly asked, was he a communist?
I refuse to enter.
All right.
You refuse to enter. You refuse to enter.
This is an invasion of my rather secret ballot, Senator. If you want to know whether I am, the Communist Party, the Liberal Party, like the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, I'm going to vote pretty soon. If you want to send some government officials to take my ballot away, a secret ballot, my constitutional right, you can see just what I am.
That's it. Have you a communist card in any communist organization, any state, Mr. Robeson?
That is, I consider, a part of the other question.
Yeah, I see.
Robeson told senators he agreed with many communist and socialist positions, and he defended the Soviet Union, which had been a U.S. ally in the war against fascism until just 3 years earlier. The proposed law never passed, 2 years later, Robeson spoke at a pro-Soviet world peace conference in Paris. The Associated Press quoted the singer as saying, "It is unthinkable that American Negroes would go to war on behalf of those who have oppressed us for generations against the Soviet Union." The weird thing about that quote is it was reported by the AP the day before Robeson actually spoke. What he said was, "We are determined to fight for peace. We do not wish to fight the Soviet Union." Still, the reported remarks, rather than the actual remarks, created an outcry, and the US State Department cancelled Robeson's passport. He was called a traitor, blacklisted, his name was removed from the list of all American football teams. Newsreels and records of Robeson were destroyed. In 1956, he was called before the infamous Un-American Activities Committee, where he defended his support for communism, invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, and refused to name others who might be communists.
Do you know, Ben? One of my dearest friends, he is as patriotic an American as can be, and you, gentlemen, are the non-patriots.
Just a minute.
You are the un-American.
The hearing is now adjourned.
I think it should be.
I've been doing all this that I can.
Can I read my statement?
No! The meeting is adjourned.
It should be.
It would be another 2 years until the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that no American could have their passport stripped from them, and Robeson was free to travel and perform around the world again. One of his first stops was in Moscow, where he was greeted as a hero, even as he sang gospel songs to an atheist crowd.
Did my Lord deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel? Did my Lord deliver?
3 years later, again in Moscow, something very strange happened to Paul Robeson. During a party in his hotel suite, the singer began acting strangely. He locked himself in a bedroom and tried to take his own life. He survived, only to attempt suicide again 3 days later. Later still, in London, he suffered panic attacks, paranoia, depression, and again tried to end his life. Paul Robeson was given electric shock therapy and he was heavily medicated. Later, he was transferred to East Germany for more psychotherapy. The official diagnosis was what was then called manic depression or bipolar disorder, although Robeson's family believed he'd been drugged, initially with high doses of the hallucinogenic LSD by CIA agents at that party in Moscow. Either way, Robeson was a shadow of his former self. Unable to perform, he lived out the final 13 years of his life in seclusion in Harlem and Philadelphia. In retrospect, Robeson's support for Stalinist Russia was naive. He was undoubtedly exploited for propaganda purposes, but his support for workers of all races made him a significant progressive and civil rights leader. So, was Paul Robeson a member of the Communist Party? As he repeatedly said, as long as he was loyal to America, the US Constitution guaranteed his right to hold views that some might regard as communist and not to have to disclose it. He was free to vote for whomever he chose. In secret, US government agencies spent years looking but never found evidence that Robeson had joined the Communist Party. As for whether they found other ways to damage him through fake quotes or drugs like LSD, well, we may never know. If you need information or...
All right. Moving right along, family. Again, that was just a bit of excerpt. Let me take that off. Okay. That, of course, gave you a little insight for those who didn't know about the great Paul Robeson. And I hope you noted that it is said that it's highly believed that when he was in London, I believe it was, that he was drugged. Because they said after that party, this was his family that said after the party, he was no longer the same. And, you know, suffer bouts of depression and other kinds of things after that. It ultimately after the first episode or whatever, he was given all these high voltage kinds of treatment and things of that nature, and it just destroyed him. And so, again, there's a lot of things that people really don't know about Paul Robeson, but one of the things that we definitely did know and do know is that he was fearless. He stood up, he spoke out, and he did it in such a way. I mean, you heard his voice. So anything that he said, the way he said it, the way he delivered it, it just hit so hard. It kind of reminded me of Mumia Abdul-Jamal. Whenever you hear Mumia's voice, you just never forget it. And the same thing with Paul Leroy Robeson. Today marks the anniversary or the commemoration of his transition. January 23rd, 1976, he died here in Philadelphia. Again, we give recognition to him. Also, really because 1951, we charged genocide. We charged genocide. Paul Robeson took the petition to the United Nations addressing the issue of the murders of our people nationwide. They submitted hundreds of names, location, age, type of murder of our people. Now, note again, 1951. And so as he did it here, simultaneously, he was working very closely with William Patterson, who was also a lawyer. And by the way, for those that do not know, Paul Robeson was also a lawyer. He was what some call a true Renaissance man, meaning he was so well-rounded, an athlete, a scholar, an artist, both drama and vocal, but also a lawyer. I literally graduated from law school, Columbia. So Paul Robeson was no joke. And again, while, you know, there's stories about, you know, his kind of social, his social endeavors, you know, they said he loved women. What black man doesn't? And, of course, during that time period, needless to say. But the point being, there's one thing that is undisputable, and that is his commitment and his courage in the fight for justice. We're going to be talking more about Paul Robeson in April, because that is actually his born day or born month, April 9th. And so he was born in 1898. And so around that time, we will be doing more about or talking more about Paul Robeson, his work, his legacy. We're committed to continuing his legacy when it comes to the issue of black human rights violations and the necessity for reparatory justice, for remedies. Irreversible, that's very important. That word is essential for us, irreversible, because we've seen forms of justice in the past, but we've also seen how it has been either taken away, revoked, sidetracked, or something. So we use the word irreversible to make it very clear, as Brother Malcolm taught us, make it plain. Okay, so that gives us a little insight about Paul Leroy Robeson. Of course, there's much, much more. And I also want to make it very clear that, you know, how he was set up in terms of, calling him a communist. Because during that time period, you know, to be a communist in the U.S., that was like, oh, my gosh, that was a nightmare, the McCarthy era and all of that. And so that was a way to, you know, to entrap him, or not to entrap him, but to set him up, to remove how much love and appreciation that many American people had for his artistry. And so in order to lessen that, they made sure they created this anti-American kind of thing that they wanted to label him with. But note, they never found any evidence of his involvement. And even if he was, because again, he was a lawyer. So even if he was, he had the right to be that. You see, there was no law against that, really. And so he did exactly what he should have done, which was to say he had the right to do certain things, and he reserved that right, and he upheld it. And he did it both legally and civically and morally. Again, Paul Robeson. We cannot forget him. And more importantly, we cannot forget his work. The work that he stood up for, the work that they attempted to ruin him, well, not attempted, they in some instances did for a while. You know, he lost a lot of money by not being able to be hired, and so forth and so on. So family, listen, again, these are so, this is so important that we understand, overstand, as some say, what our people had to go through to get us where we are today. So let us fast forward. Okay, this was 1951, leading up again to the 1970s. Then in the 1960s, we had, of course, Brother Malcolm X. We're going to be talking more about him next month and then again in May. But for right now, a, shall we say, protege or a student, let's do that one, of the great Malcolm X was Imari Obadeli. And here are some words from him. Check this out, family.
Dr. Obadeli also served as president of the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa. The Provisional Government followed the Malcolm X doctrine, leads the movement to establish an independent New Africa, that is black, nation state, and five states of the Deep South. The five states are Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and South Carolina. The high point of the provisional government's work occurred in Mississippi between 1970 and 1976. The movement has been slowly rebuilding since then and has achieved a new momentum. While teaching at Prairie View, Brother Imari maintains residence in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, from which he carries on his duties in the independence movement, the target area for the first free area of the Republic of New Africa is the western Mississippi and the part of Louisiana along the Mississippi River from Memphis in the north to New Orleans in the south. That has been named the Cush District. Dr. Obadeli was born and grew up in the South Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He is author of several books, including Free the Land, America the Nation State, and A Beginner's Outline of the History of African People. He is a contributor to the small but important book entitled Reparations, Yes. In August 1971, in order to halt the organizing activity of the provisional government in Jackson, Mississippi, the FBI and the Jackson police staged an attack on the RNA official residence in that city after having failed to destabilize the provisional government's work by other illegal COINTELPRO means. A police superintendent, lieutenant, died in that attack, and another policeman and another FBI agent were wounded. They sent the RNA 11 to jail, including Brother Umari, who spent 19 months in jail in Mississippi and 3 years in federal penitentiary. He was released in 1980 and resumed his work in the independence movement and is here to give us an update and information tonight. I bring you Brother Imari Obadeli.
Thank you. Thank you. Verily, verily I say unto you, that except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. The 12th chapter of John, 24th verse. I bring you greetings from the Provisional Government Republic of New Africa and from the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. I want to greet especially the organizers and conveners, Brother Hannibal, Sister Ray Jones, Brother Shango, Dr. Jones, and all of you distinguished people who have come here tonight, not only to honor Malcolm X, but also to talk about and plan for and finally act upon our future. I'm going to talk very briefly and center my remarks today on the issue of reparations. You will recall that reparations is the idea that black people, in our context, should be paid for slavery, that even those of us who exist today should receive payment for the unjust war and the enslavement of our people in this country. Unjust war waged against us by the United States and sanctioned in the United States Constitution. Now, when you think of Malcolm X, and recall that much of what he did was to urge us to be self-reliant, it is not unfair to ask why then would we connect Malcolm X to reparations? Well, the answer is rather simple. First of all, Malcolm was the founder of Muhammad Speaks newspaper for the Nation of Islam, and on the back, the quest of the Nation of Islam, as enunciated by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, called for land anywhere as part of a reparations demand and an old one. It also called for the oppressor to provide means for a given amount of time so that the nation of the oppressed people on this independent land would have a real opportunity to build. So that while Malcolm stressed self-determination, excuse my horse, since we drove in from Baton Rouge, and I haven't quite gotten over the little hoarseness that I got during that trip. Malcolm talk about self-reliance necessarily had to encompass questions of justice on the one hand and questions of economic development. So what I want to do very briefly tonight is, one, talk about the economic realities of, and indeed the history of reparations. I'd like to move on then and speak a bit about the Conyers bill that is in Congress at the present time for reparations and the work of the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. And then I want to conclude with a few remarks on our own obligations and on our reality for winning reparations in our time. Now, obviously, the thing that I read from John in the Christian Bible has a great deal of relevance with Malcolm X. You who are here are obviously the fruit that came about because Malcolm died, like the seed. And now it's bearing fruit, not only with us here, who maybe are special in a sense, that we have studied and we have been involved in many things that relate to our understanding of Malcolm's work, but the fruit also are young brothers and sisters who yet do not have a clear understanding of Malcolm's mission and work. But the fruit is here. Now, what about this matter of reparations, payment for slavery? Where did this idea begin? Sometimes we like to think of General Sherman and his march to the sea. You will recall that during the, what was effectively the last year of the Civil War, Sherman cut loose from his supply lines and marched across Georgia, got to Atlanta, and went from Atlanta to the sea. And in doing this, he gathered behind him a great number of people. The Africans, the new Africans, Africans in a new place, us. New Africans who had left the plantations and followed this army because they knew it meant freedom. Now, this general, William Tecumseh Sherman, is the same general that in 1868, the same year as the 14th Amendment, would go into the Navajo territory and for the U.S. Army impose an unequal treaty upon the Navajo and therefore contribute to the oppression of the Navajo. But in 1865, he was courteous enough to take 20 of us who were some free and some newly free, and ask the basic question, what is it you want? And then listen to the answer. As a result of that answer, General Sherman, our answer was, as always, land and education. As a result of that conversation, Sherman took the Sea Islands. He didn't wait for Congress. He took the Sea Isles, and then from Savannah all the way south to the St. John's River in the north of Florida, said that all of this land was to be set aside for black people, a sort of reparations, a sort of giving of something to repair black people for the suffering and the economic dislocation, the theft of our labor and the unjust war, the cultural assault which Americans had placed upon us. So 30 miles back along the river, 30 miles back, Sherman, under his military power, assigned this land to the new Africans. And then General Saxton went out and began to help us settle on this land in 40-acre tracts. 40-acre tracts. Now, we read the back of the book, so we know the end of the story. We know that the Congress would ultimately give the power over this land to the president, who then was Andrew Johnson, who, as Du Bois says in Black Reconstruction, had become a black hater, a new African hater. And Andrew Jackson decided that this land would be given back, to the ex-Confederates. And so they used the army to move us off that land. Now, in some cases, we got additional land. Now, it is customary for us to say, when we talk about reparations, that white people have never given us anything in terms of reparations, have never acknowledged the cruelty and inhumanity of slavery, and indeed, probably never will. Well, that's okay. There are a great many things that we are entitled to say in terms of our, well, you may use the words propaganda, in terms of our reframing of realities in order for us to proceed to victory. But it is also important, particularly at a time like this, to look at some of the facts. It turns out that white people at one moment did have a feeling that black people ought to be compensated. In fact, as Du Bois points out in Black Reconstruction, during the debate leading to the second Freedmen's Bill in 1965, a majority, a great majority of both the House and the Senate, who at that time, remember this is before the Reconstruction Act, at that time these were all white people. These whites, by a great majority, decided that we should have the 40 acres, that it would be sold to us at a nominal price. One, Charles Sumner, suggested that 10 cents an acre, and then we would be able to buy it later at, again, a nominal price. So the idea of the 40 acres was put forward. So let's admit, white folks, at the end of that war, a terrible, costly war, not only for them, but for us. They make movies all the time about how they suffered and families were torn and blood on this continent, but it was a terrible war. for us. And at the end of that war, when many white people had to face up to questions of humanity and questions of what America should be like. And despite the way we teach, remember we teach that really this was the industrial north taking over the agricultural south, et cetera, fine. But as human beings, many white people had to face whether or not they were going to continue with white supremacy. They decided, of course, that white supremacy would continue. But they also felt that black people should have something with which to start again. They said, well, what happened to the 40 acres? We don't have my brother. What happened to the 40 acres? Andrew Johnson vetoed the bill. And we complain, of course, and rightly so, that the Congress then could not muster the two-thirds majority. But in looking at what happened, let us concede that more than a majority had voted for the 40 acres and a mule. And so now, you know, it is not then hard to realize that somewhere in the midst of all this talk about land for us, that our people would have the idea, as General Saxton was to say when he reported on a successful Sea Island venture, we were entitled to believe that the federal government made a promise for 40 acres and a mule. And maybe even the promise of the 40 acres goes back beyond General Sherman. White folks, when they indentured other white folks, when they held white servants during colonial times, in South Carolina and in Maryland, used to give an indentured free person freedom dues. They did that in all the colonies. You had been indentured, you worked for 7 years. If you were a criminal, you might have worked for 14 years, occasionally even 24. And when you whites were free, there were freedom dues, sometimes $50, an axe, an old suit and a new suit of clothes, a barrel of corn. In South Carolina, where we were long in the majority, and in Maryland, they gave the freed indentured servant 50 acres. So the idea that somehow we could help ourselves if we were just given a little to work with is very old. Christopher Austin, a historian in Detroit, reminds us very effectively, his book should be out this year, that we have never forgotten reparations, that in the 1890s, black people across this country organized into something called the Ex-Slaves Bounty and Reparations Society, collected 50 cents apiece, waged their campaign at Congress, and indeed found some white congressmen willing to support the idea that blacks should be compensated for slavery, or at least given something with which to begin to build economically new lives. What happened to the Ex-Slaves Bounty and Reparations Society? The sister reminds us of strange fruit hanging from the trees. But while we have usually been able to find some white allies, some of whom maybe we can even believe really wanted to help us for no reason except that they believed in justice, and some of whom saw the black genius and the black beauty such as we have witnessed here tonight, we were always able to find some white allies. But the American government has been eternally hostile to black people. The American government jailed these men and women who were in the leadership of this movement, women in the leadership of this movement, They jailed him. Prelude to Marcus Garvey. Soliciting through the mails. But then Queen Mother Moore perhaps serves as another beacon to us. We love and honor Queen Mother for many things, but in the 40s, she was a one-woman campaign to save brothers in the South from being assassinated for all lynch, that is, either by electric chair or by mobs, for all the silliness that white women in this white society used to do, talking about how you looked at them or pinched them or made some remark to them. And Queen Mother, particularly in Louisiana, worked to get governors and others to commute these sentences and work with all of the audacity, some of which maybe in her physical presentation she has lost today, but never in spirit. And Queen Mother Moore going across the South, saving lives of young black men and demanding reparations, forming the Ethiopian women. And somewhere in the back of her mind, with a concept of the legal idea of laches, meaning that if you have a right and you don't do anything about this right, then you can't claim it later. And Queen Mother and Dara Abubakar and Virginia Collins and others out of New Orleans and in the South formed the Ethiopian Women's Association. They went to New York. And indeed, Queen Mother would get her name from Baba Adefumi in New York. And they sent a missive to the United Nations in 1963 because they had an idea that unless within 100 years of the Emancipation Proclamation we made a formal demand to international sources, we might as well forget reparations. So they did it to try to preserve for us the idea and the right to avoid this legal concept of laches. Queen Mother, Virginia Collins, women in the South, preserving for us this right. And all of you here, most of you here, except the very young, know the modern story. Republic of New Africa in 1968 formed the cause, a large part of the work of Queen Mother, but these were the Malcolm Ikes. The members of the Malcolm X Society formed after his assassination, who then called the Black Government Conference. And when we finished that, Betty Shabazz was there and leaned over and said to me, when they nominate, I would be willing to serve as second vice president. And she was named second vice president of the provisional government. And here, where a Declaration of Independence was concluded, part of it says, we claim no rights from America except those rights that belong to people all over the world. And these include the right to reparations for the grievous harm inflicted upon us, our people, by the United States. The Republic of New Africa people went into the streets. Some of you in Chicago may have first encountered provisional government people asking you to sign a petition, and evidently we have petitions out there now to support this bill of John Kearns, and I hope you'll take the opportunity to sign. And if you would like to be part of the National Reparations Coalition, just put an asterisk by your name because there will be formal meetings here in Chicago. But then there's the African People's Socialist Party that began a series of tribunals calling people in to testify, to make a record as to reparations, as to the harm. And you lawyers who are in the audience know that one of the things that you do all the time is to value life. I mean, obviously you can't put dollar signs on somebody's life. But you have the task as lawyers to go into the courtroom, somebody's been hit by a public bus, and you evaluate the age of the person and how many years they would have lived if they had not been hit, and what they would have been if they had been able to get a little more education, and you value life. Obviously, no dollar signs can take the place of someone who has been killed or even injured. I mean, you don't want $2 million even for your leg. Really. Lawyers value life. So the African People's Socialist Party undertook to make a record so that we can begin to say, what is it that they owe us? What is the minimum that they owe? And if you can plan in your mind, when you take into consideration the Middle Passage, when you take into consideration just the war waged against us in North America under the United States Constitution's provision of what we call the fugitive slave provision, which said that you could not even leave just peacefully and quietly and go away because the whole force of the United States government, Army, Navy, Marines stood against you, their court system stood against you, never mind that, as the sister said, they will cut off Gabriel's head and hang it on the post. Gabriel understood that if he lost the revolution, that they were going to do that, so he knew what kind of people they were dealing with, so they stuck his head and those of his companions on the post and arrayed the walks into the town of Richmond with these heads so that everybody, and particularly the black people, would understand that you don't raise your hand against white people. So we understood. The revolutionaries understood that if they lost, that would be their suit. But what about the little old lady? Reading her Bible and decides, unlike the Hebrew, she won't take any gold and silver. Won't say to the people who have been harming her, let me just borrow this so I can go out into the desert and pray. The little old lady who just leaves quietly at night watching the North Star barefoot. The full force of the United States government was against her, not just Gabriel or Nat Turner. And so the African People's Socialist Party began to make the record. Come in and testify. What can we say? And you know, what can they give us here? It was obvious before the calculations were even made that they owed us the whole thing. And so the African People's Socialist Party worked in the streets and in Baltimore and in Tallahassee and certain other places across the United States trying to raise this consciousness. And in 1987, the Provisional Government's Legislature, this is the national body, hope some of you who really believe in land, who really believe that we should have independence, I hope some of you will run for this national Congress. Doesn't have any power yet because we're not free, but we need the Congress before we are free. I hope in the RNA elections this year, those of you who are really serious and will bring your talent and your money will run and be elected out of Chicago or wherever you may happen to live to this national body. They decided that we would try to call together black people from across this country to see if we could form a coalition that was not just land-based nationalists like myself, but that spread out to the sororities and the fraternities, the churches, that spread out to all groups. And we said we wanted to, at that time, work, make a more positive new African contribution to the freedom of our people in Southern Africa. And mind you, that's another story, but Africans have done much here. Now, we obviously can criticize ourselves and say we should do more, but we've done much here, and we wanted to do more. And we said the other thing, we'd use these twin things of reparations in South Africa. And we had long debates, and finally people said, let us just concentrate on reparations. And Nana Shishabi, who is the representative for the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania, said, yes, do that. That will help us in South Africa. And so the National Conference of Black Lawyers came together with the provisional government and formed this national coalition of blacks for reparations in America in Cobra. And as I said, the petitions are outside for you to sign. And if you want to work with this, please just put an asterisk beside your name. And in Cobra, maybe it was just the time. Came along at a time when a stalwart brother in Detroit who had worked with the movement and worked specifically with the Republic of New Africa, named Raymond Jenkins, a real estate broker who always put his money where his mouth was and his energy in his body, began another movement for reparations, and he went to a friend of his named Bill Owens, who's a senator in the Massachusetts legislature, and they talked. And Bill Owens said, look, I promised my father that if I ever got into a position to put in a reparations bill, I will do so. He did so. And so in Massachusetts, a bill has been put into the legislature saying that Massachusetts owes black people and should pay. Now, obviously, Massachusetts is not rushing to pass that resolution. And the way the brothers and sisters there are handling it, we will have opportunities to go and debate. And I want to make testimony. I want to come back to that because this is a serious fight, and we need all of you. I mean, we've got some serious oppositions out there, and I'll come back to that. And then Ray Jenkins went back to Detroit, and he talked to some people on the Detroit City Council, and he talked to the county governing body, and both of those bodies passed a resolution saying that the United States ought to pay the reparations. It's kind of interesting. Detroit and Michigan owe also for what they did to us after slavery. But anyhow, they at least passed the reparations resolution demanding that Detroit act. And incidentally, Ms. Janita Tolson of Baton Rouge was kind enough to come here with me. We're both members of the Baton Rouge and Cobra group, and of course I helped to form it, but they sort of run this thing by themselves and tell me that they do. But in anyhow, in Baton Rouge, Peggy Bookter and Herbert Bookter, who are our leaders there, have been able to get the Louisiana State House, or rather one of the brothers in the Louisiana State House to put in the reparations motion demanding that Louisiana support the Conyers bill. And now they have a second reparations amendment which demands that Louisiana pay itself. So, and that hasn't been put in yet, but we expect that it will in the next few weeks. So the history of reparations is continuous. And Queen Mother Moore's concern about laches does not have to really concern us. But then we recall that the United States has never really given us any kind of justice except when they were forced to. For those of us who were in the RNA 11 and went to jail in Mississippi after they tried to shoot us up and they died, it is always a bit of ironic humor to hear people talk about the system works. They're talking about Huey Newton got out of jail, but you know, as I know, that you got him out. The American system did not gratuitously turn Huey Newton out of jail. They look at Angela Davis. System works. The United States system did not gratuitously turn Angela Davis out. The system doesn't work, and we have to force the system to do things. So whether or not there's a doctrine of laches that could possibly have stood in our way, it really couldn't, because we have never forgotten reparations. It really doesn't matter to our enemies, and the United States is our enemy until they are willing to sign a peace treaty. As you know, they never signed it with Elijah Muhammad, not to mention Denmark VC, Gabriel. They haven't signed it with the Republic of New Africa. Never apologized to you, even the bill in Congress that was good that I mentioned that was going to make it possible for you to buy 40 acres. Never apologized to you. The United States is our enemy until they cease this war against us. Now, the enemy has to be forced. If they don't have laches, they're going to think of something else. And this is what I meant when I said we have a serious problem. Let me move on to John Kanye's bill. John Kanye's bill asks for a commission to study the harm that was done to black people during slavery and afterwards by discrimination. And I know what you say, another commission. Andy Thompson and all these political scientists know that when you set up a commission, that's a way to get rid of the problem. What you do is you create a commission to say, we're doing something, folks. And then when the commission report comes out, you say, thank you, and you put it on your desk, and that's the end of it. But Kanye's plan is, in a way, an opportunity for us to bring testimony to Congress and shape a bill. That's what it comes down to. Now, that's easy, isn't it? Everybody knows that they killed somewhere close to 80% of the people that they put on the slave ships, right? And we all know that they took our names and our common sense. I mean, you're too familiar with that. I won't even go into that. Assaulted our personality, and only your figure. I just sit back and, I mean, I'm so happy to be a new African, a black person. I sit back and marvel at you all. You just never stay still and never accept what people attempt to put on you. Now, we can criticize each other about what we do and that this is dumb or that's dumb. That's fine. We're entitled to criticize each other, and we're entitled to perfect a proper approach to our liberation. But you are so busy organizing everywhere, achieving in educational fields and just doing everything that they told you you couldn't do, flying space shuttles, commanding, becoming mayors, even though you sometimes forget who you are. I'm just doing every kind of thing. I remember when I worked for the Army Tank Automotive Command, and I would go to different cities, and sure enough, because I was a writer for technical manuals, and we'd go there to supervise this writing of manuals, and I'd look around, and there, in many cases, there was some black engineer, even in those days, sitting in the back doing a whole lot. So such a dynamic people who never simply sat by and said, boss, don't hit me, and I'll just be happy to be here. Such a dynamic fighting people. But we got problems. Because you have heard that revisionist economists tell us that it wasn't too bad in slavery economically. That the poor white workers in the North had more of their surplus value taken from them than we did, right? So don't think that you can walk up to Congress backwards and blindfolded and throw the ball through the hoop. There's going to be some folks up there that are going to tell you, y'all didn't have it bad, and while we're thinking about it, we ought to help the white folks. So the economists have to come in with their serious work done. We look at Hofstadter, he said, well, you know, Professor Hofstadter, great guy. So that something like 12,000 black people, this is not the exact figures, were all those that went into North America. Now here at the end of the Civil War, we're 4 million people held in slavery. And remember, part of that re-education, never allow the students to say slaves. It's people held in slavery. But you never forget the repression and the resistance. No slaves, people held in slavery. Now, we say, we lost all these people in the Middle Passage. And they say, did you? And see, like, remember that some of our figures, we were on 100 million. And so we think that they pulled 100 million people out of Africa, or at least between those killed in Africa and those who got on the way, 100 million people. These white folks say, no, that didn't happen. There weren't even 100 million people living in Africa there. You see? You got serious problems as we begin to, as the lawyers do, value life. And so our historians have to be prepared. Don't get mad at John Conyers because he put in a bill asking for a commission. Just get yourself together to come down there with your facts right when the hearings open. It may not be this year. It may be later. And what else? Now, I think Brother Hannibal told me I'm going to have a chance tomorrow to talk something about the Republic of New Africa, but I just want to mention this to you. We in the provisional government take the position that black people should not say we're American citizens. I mean, this relates to also this question of our using the term African-American. And I asked one of my colleagues, I said, Ron Walters, who was one of those who pushed and said, look, Ron, you know, why use this term African-Americans? Because, you know, we're not Americans. And he said, yeah, but just to get us to say African now, it's such an improvement that maybe we ought to take this step. But what concerns us is maybe let's just say Africans. We're just Africans. I mean, like we didn't say we're Africans in the New World, so we're new Africans or Africans because in the 200 years between 1660 and 1860, we have, what, 10, 7 generations. And in that time, who were these Africans? They didn't come from one country, one state, one nation in Africa. They came from several. I mean, even though they say, well, we came basically from the West Coast, but you remember, it was the Portuguese who attacked into the Angola region and who also went around and attacked themselves into Mozambique. And so we came from all over the continent. And here we had many people from many different nations who could not stay together. In Africa, you knew who you could marry. Once you get here, you've got to marry the fellow or the woman who was next to you. And so we have, in America, across 7 to 10 generations, a fusing of people from many different African nations and states. And then you've got the Indian genes, and you've got the European genes in our gene pool. And so here, then, you have a common history that solidifies the people. We know, we say we know who's black. And how do we know that? Here I am walking around looking like I'm white, even got blue eyes. How do you know I'm black? You know it because, not only because the gene pool, because you know my brother and sister who may not have blue eyes and fair skin, not only because of gene pool, but you know it also because of the common perspective and the common history. So when we look, for instance, at people on the same territory in the same space, maybe it's easier if we look, say, at the Mohawk or the Passamaquoddy or some of those in New York or New England. Here, when the whites come, the Europeans come to Massachusetts, they are on the same land with the Passamaquoddy. They are in the same time frame. They are experiencing the same event, which will be war, because we read the end of the book, so we know it turns into war. So here they are, same time, same place, same time frame, two different perspectives. The whites are saying, oh, God, thank you for giving us this wonderful land. And the Indians are saying, much like, God, what did we do to lose this land? Or as we would say, God, what did we do wrong, Brother Chandra, to get us in this mess? What can we do to get out of it? See, same time, same place, same event, two different perspectives. And those two different perspectives in history create two different nations. See, the nation is what evolves. We can't create it. Queen Mother couldn't. Elijah Muhammad couldn't. The nation evolves. It's not made up. Either we are or we are not. And we are because of gene pool perspective and history. We don't have state power. Gabriel tribe. Denmark DC tribe. Tunis Campbell tried and for a while succeeded. Sea Islands off of South Carolina, Georgia. The red towns and black towns joined together in Florida before 1819 and succeeded. Afro-Indian Seminole State for a while. But in general, we have not succeeded in freeing the land. We don't have state power. Yes, we have an army. When we think state power, think army. But so small now, so tiny now. We are a nation without state power. And so in overthrowing colonial education, Brother Hannibal needs help. We all need help. We're going to get it. I mean, because this is an essential part of our reparations campaign. We cannot demand certain things if we don't, as Malcolm says in here in the education piece, if we don't know the past. And then if we don't know the terminology that is used today, and isn't that the terminology is right or wrong, but some of it is so potent in its acceptance that we have to understand the terminology in order to deal and get what we want. Again, not a question of whether the terminology is right or wrong, but we have to understand it. We must not be shy in the classroom. Brother Kiyasi was just telling me about his experiences, how principals come up and say, you've got to teach this and this and this. And he goes in, he says, okay, I'll do that, and teaches the liberation of his people. We must not be afraid in the classrooms to teach that we are a nation. It's the oppressed people, no matter whether Europe or Africa, who retain some sense of their nationality, strive to build state power. You see it a little bit today in Estonia and Latvia. They understood that they were a separate people, nations, that the Soviet claim to their land was bogus. And so they fight or struggle to free themselves, to build, to have state power, the army. We know that in Poland's history, the Germans have come in from the west, the Russians have come in from the east, from time to time, wiped out Poland. And note that in many instances, Poles who lived under the Germans said, it sure is cool around here. These Germans are such marvelous, mechanistic people, and they let us go to these schools. We ought to just forget this thing about Poland and those who were living in the Russian area. Does this sound familiar? So what do we need Poland for? Because we're all Slavs around here. Great Russian people. What do we need Poland for? But some Poles understood that their history was distinct from the history of the Russians or the Germans. And the moment they got the chance, it came at the end of World War II, there's going to be a new and free Poland. So it's not just us, but we must fight here against the colonial education. We must be ashamed that children in Soweto would go into the streets in opposition to colonial education to be taught in Afrikaans. And we teachers walk in and collect our salary. We don't even... And so what they would go into the streets in opposition to colonial education to be taught in Afrikaans. And we teachers walk in and collect our salary. We don't even back up to it. Go straight up there smiling and collect our salaries and teach horse manure. Teach nothing about a new African nation. You must teach that. These young people who are wearing Malcolm medallions and singing about Malcolm are entitled to learn from you and me. They are entitled to have the explanations that they need. As a teacher, I always say to young people, you are entitled to trust your professors, Imani. Have faith. But question everything. And it is important for us to put the information in front of the young people. Queen Mother did not make up the new African nation. It grew. It evolved like every nation. And we struggle for state power. My reference is Malcolm X's message to the grassroots on record, not in the book. Even in the record, some things are missing, but maybe the Schoenberg has now the entire tape, and you can hear it there, and maybe we can get around to getting it to reproduce. Message to the grassroots, talking about statehood, really. Independent land. Now, think not that we have an easy battle here at Congress. They don't regard you as any subjugated nation because you walk around talking about you and America, whatever that is. American? Even the Indians, that's the wrong name, isn't it? Okay. Even the Mohawk, the Passamaquoddy, Cherokee, and others, and now particularly the Oglala Sioux, who acted so magnificently in the 70s under the leadership of AIM, the American Indian Movement, sometimes refer to themselves as Native Americans. Americans? But where did that name come from? The little children in this room can tell us it was America's first Pucci and Italian. When the Americans wrote the Federalist Papers to argue New Yorkers and others into passing the or supporting the present Constitution of the United States, which we call the Constitution, they use the term in there, Americans. And they talk about we Americans whom God bless, people of one language, et cetera, Americans. When they defined Americans, they meant themselves. Contrary to what we teach our children, I guess I have to say we ignorantly in the sense that we just ignore the facts, but it's a disgrace. Contrary to what we teach our children, they never meant us. I noticed Brother Quacko Walker and I did a study of DC textbooks, and that'll be out very soon, but those textbooks don't mention the fugitive slave provision of the Constitution of the United States. Extraordinary. Extraordinary. They mention three-fifths person. They mention that the trade could go on against Africa for 20 years, which meant, of course, war against Africa. Not the fugitive slave provision. It's in there. They don't talk about it. Because that was war against us. And the books today now say that Justice Story, who did, Dred Scott decision, Taney, thank you, who wrote the Lee decision, the books today say law school and high school, the court disgraced itself. The court disgraced itself. This chap merely wrote what the facts were. He said, sorry, folks, Mr. Scott had come to court seeking not only his freedom, but the freedom of his children. I mean, this is a monster system here. And his wife. And just said, sorry. He said, like, in this modern day of 1857, we don't think bad of black people.
They knew Frederick Douglass and others.
In this modern day, we don't think bad of black people, but we must interpret this Constitution in the way that it was intended to be interpreted by Jefferson and all those chaps who wrote it.
All right, family. We are going to end it there. It's probably about another maybe 15 minutes or so, 20 minutes or so, but we're going to end it there and continue on Saturday for our regular radio broadcast. And so we invite you all to join us 10:30 p.m., New Day Resurrection Liberation on Saturday, the 28th, I believe it is, and we will resume this conversation. I want to remind you again, today we kick off officially the Recharge Genocide 21 War Chest. Give you more information about that on Saturday. You will be able to go online now and support the War Chest. You'll be able to see what the War Chest is about, why we put it together, and why now, in the spirit of Kuji Chandelier, we're going to see some real kinds of things. All right, family, we're going to close this session. Thank you all again. This, again, was one of our first tutorials that we do on New Day, and we'll be doing more on YouTube and other vehicles. And until then, we're going to say, Pamoja to the Shinda. Together, we shall win. Free Mumia, free them all. Peace out.